I want to say good morning in the worst way. And I know Mr. Brown this morning wanted to say good afternoon in the worst way. We're creatures of habits. Last time I spoke was a few weeks ago, and I talked about things that each of the feast days teach us. And after each one of the festivals, I'd ask the question, how could we possibly do without Passover, Pentecost, Days of Unleavened Bread, Out of Order, Tabernacles, Atonement? How could we do without any of these days? And today we're in the middle of Days of Unleavened Bread, and I wanted to ask the question, how many great events of the Bible occurred on a feast day? So I was thinking about that over the past few weeks. We can read about the first Passover, and let's do that in Exodus 12. We reviewed this. We spent a bit of time reviewing this and think about how great some of these events really were. Exodus 12 and verse 1 in that chapter. 12:1, now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. And that's where we are now. And as we're driving in, we see all these trees blooming and flowers. And it does make a lot more sense to have this as the beginning time of the year. Verse 3, speak to all the congregations of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for the household. And in verse 6, you shall keep that lamb until the 14th day of the same month, and then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. At twilight. We recently began our Passover celebration here at twilight, the same time. This is the beginning. And so they killed the lamb at twilight. Passover is for our redemption, our salvation, our saving. And we see in verse 7 here, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the house where they eat it. So they're putting it around the door. And you might ask, what's the message? What's the message? Why were they doing this? What were they thinking? Can we put ourselves in their shoes? And they knew it was something very important. And they had just seen plagues of water turn to blood. Thunder and hail, and we just sang, how great thou art. I hear the mighty thunder and powerful thunder and hail. And these plagues on Egypt, darkness, frogs, flies, locusts, great events, miracles during this time of the Passover. And the message was for them as they put the blood of the lamb on their doors, is tonight you will be protected by the blood of the lamb. It's for your safety. It's for your saving. It's a physical salvation for these people. And they were told, after you do this, go inside your door and close the door and don't come back out. So, you know, it was a somber time. It was a sober time. It was an interesting time. It was an exciting time. And then we proceed to the final miracle to free them from Pharaoh's grip. And that's in verses 12 and 13. And God says, for I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. And I can do this because I am the Lord. I am God. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see it, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you and destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So this was a sign. And we know God has placed other signs within and on His church. One applies very well to what we're doing right now. We're keeping God's Sabbath day. And this is a sign between us and God, which is why we're here now. Verse 14, another sign about the Passover. So this day shall be to you a memorial. And it's a sign for you. You shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting covenant. This is for physical Israel, and it's for spiritual Israel. This carries through for us today. And then by this last plague where God passed over the physical Israelites, Pharaoh, a type of Satan, finally released the Israelites. It's a type of us now. We are the spiritual Israelites. Well, they were the physical. And then there's a New Testament fulfillment of this day and another lamb's blood. In this case, Christ, the Lamb of God, the Passover lamb, provided, as Dr. Sagai said, the only mechanism there is for us to escape Satan, the god of this age, and the present king of the earth. And you know, when I talk about Satan, I just describe him as a mean, ruthless, a vile being. That's what he is. And this is who we need to escape, the death grip of sin, the death grip of Satan. And I won't turn there because we've been there recently, including in the Passover, but Isaiah 53:7 talks about this time where the Lamb's blood, Christ's blood, will be there for a Passover for us. And in that chapter it says he was led as a lamb to the slaughter. And Dr. Sagagian spoke about these messianic prophecies. This is certainly one. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter. Yet it pleased God to bruise him. And this is reminiscent of Genesis 3:15, where Christ prophesied of himself, I will come back and I will bruise you, Satan. I will bruise your head, but you will bruise my heel. You will be able to kill me. Yes, it pleased God to bruise Christ. And so this is a prophecy that came true. And also in Isaiah 53, his soul, his life, will be an offering for our sin. So we find all these verses in Isaiah speak of a very big event. Big event in the salvation that would again take place over Passover, the Passover. When David wrote these verses, he was looking ahead a long time. Kind of like now, we're looking ahead a long time, maybe not a long time anymore, to manifestation of the Feast of Trumpets when Christ returns. And I expect as Christ died on Passover, he will return on a Day of Trumpets. We don't know. We don't know which one. I imagine Satan will be bound on a Day of Atonement. We'll see as we move forward. But David was looking ahead a long time for something that hasn't happened. And today as we sit here, we look back a long time to this event. It's now well behind us. And the fulfillment of this event is spoken of in Matthew 26. So let's look there in the New Testament. This big event associated with a feast day in Matthew 26. In verse 2 of that chapter, we again were here in the sermonette in this same chapter for different reasons. Matthew 26, 2, and Christ said, you know that after 2 days is the Passover. Think about this being you. And I'll be delivered up to be killed. And what Christ is telling them, and how hard this would be, is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. And in verse 18 of this chapter, go to the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. They're not really getting the picture, but he's telling them again, I'm going to be killed soon. I'm coming to the end of this. I'm not going to be around much longer. My time is at hand. But he's still about business, about God's business. He said, I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. And this shows a different picture of Christ than the world often puts forth, with long hair and perhaps a bit effeminate and not a very strong man. Christ was a very brave man, a very strong man. And here he knows he's about to die, and he's composed, and he's working for the good of his disciples, and he's about God's business. We might notice here in this same chapter with Peter, he told Peter, you will betray me 3 times before morning dawns. And that's quite a lot to say. And Peter didn't understand, couldn't believe that could possibly be true. Think what he did for Peter by telling him that in the big picture, in the long picture. Think how that affected Peter later. Look in this same chapter 26 toward the end, verses 73 to 75. And we find what Christ spoke about here. Verse 73, and a little later those who stood by came up and said to Peter, surely you are one of them, for your speech betrays you. Peter spoke like a Galilean. He didn't speak like someone from Jerusalem. It's kind of like when my wife talks, you know she's not from the Bronx. Your speech betrays you. And then he began to curse and swear, and he said, I don't know the man. Immediately, the rooster crowed. And Peter, remembering the word of Jesus who had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. How did that affect him? So he went out and he wept bitterly. He just sobbed over what had happened. Tremendous lesson there for Peter. And back to verse 20 of this same chapter. Verse 20. When evening had come, he sat down with the 12. So he's working with the 12 this evening, just as we kept the Passover, with evening at twilight. He sat down with the 12. He's working with them. Verse 26, and as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And what he's saying is I've got a pretty rough night coming, and I'm going to go through a lot of abuse, and just as I just broke this bread in verse 27, then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sin," again knowing what he was about to face. So Christ at that time went on to fulfill these things, as we just reviewed over the Passover, a few days passed, and he allowed himself to be sacrificed. He could have prevented that, but this was something that he desired to do, part of the plan. The day on which this profound event, the crucifixion, occurred was the 14th day of the first month of God's calendar, the same day, the very same day on which the Passover lambs were slain back in Exodus 12 that we just read about. Or we could read the same thing in Leviticus 23:5. I'll just read that. The 14th day of the first month at even is the Lord's Passover. This is the same day on which Christ was killed. Paul would later tell the congregation at Corinth that Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. That's 1 Corinthians 5:7. These Old Testament and New Testament Passover events were huge. Putting that blood over the door, protecting them from the death of the firstborn, protecting Israel, physical salvation, Christ's sacrifice, protecting us, spiritual salvation. Huge events associated with Passover. What other big events occurred on God's festival days? As we move forward on the other end of the spring festivals is Pentecost. And we know God gave the Ten Commandments and established a covenant with physical Israel on that day. Let's go back to Exodus 19 and see some of the events there. Exodus 19 and verse 1. Exodus 19 and verse 1. In the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. In verse 10, then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes, make them clean, get them ready." Verse 16, then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings. Again, how great thou art. I hear the mighty thunder, and I'm sure this was very mighty thunder, and a thick cloud on the mountain. And the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace. The whole mountain quaked greatly. So this is a picture. This is one where it would have our attention to be there, to be watching. Verse 19, and when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder. Kind of an amazing statement here. Moses spoke, and God answered him by voice. And in verse 20, God gave the Ten Commandments, and God spoke all these words, saying, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Because of this you should know, out of the house of bondage, that there are no other gods before me. You shall have no other gods before me." Verse 3, and God gave the Ten Commandments. And in verse 18, with these big events, now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. And they said to Moses, "You speak with us, and we will hear you. But let not God speak with us, lest we die." And part of this is so God could have their attention and understand and convict them how important this was. So this was a Pentecost when God established a covenant with physical Israel. In the New Testament, God started his church, spiritual Israel, in contrast to physical, at Sinai on the same day, the Feast of Pentecost. Let's quickly look at that in Acts 2. this feast day. I need this podium to be a half inch wider. And then that would fit here. Acts 2. In verse 1, when the day of Pentecost, okay, days we just don't hear much about outside of the church, when the day of Pentecost had fully come, and they were all with one accord in one place. In verse 4, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other languages, is how we can read that, as the Spirit gave them utterance. We see these are other languages in verse 9. The Parthians were there, the Medes, the Elamites were dwelling in Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia. Verse 10 continues with people of different backgrounds and different languages. They all heard in their own language. Verse 12, so they were all amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, whatever could this mean? Others mocking said, they are full of wine. They are full of new wine. And then Peter, who denied Christ three times, who was weak, has been through things that changed him since then, and he gave a moving message that convicted their hearts and the conscience of many of them there. Peter, verse 14, standing up with the 11, raised his voice and said to them, men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and heed my words. So he sounds like a different man here. It's part of what Christ worked through him at the Passover. For these men are not drunk, as you're saying, as you suppose. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. That really doesn't make sense, is what Peter is saying here. But this is what was spoken of by the prophet Joel in verse 17. And it shall come to pass in the last days, said God. And here they're not in the last days. This is a forebear of what will happen in the last days, but it's happening with the first fruits now with Pentecost. It shall come to pass in the last days that I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh. And that'll be a great thing we can see in the millennium when God does this, when Satan is no longer around with this message of Pentecost. I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. Your old men shall dream dreams. Verse 37 of this chapter. After the message of Peter, now when they heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, men and brethren, what shall we do? And then Peter said to them, repent and let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ, or starting the church, day of Pentecost, for the remission of sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. Pentecost, the very day, the very same day as the Ten Commandments were given, the day that Christ started the New Testament church. Christ obviously considered this high festival day to be important based on these big events of salvation that occurred that day. Big events associated with festival days. During the spring of the year, immediately after the Passover, but before the Feast of Pentecost, falls another biblical feast. The seven-day feast or festival of unleavened bread, which we're in now. We're in the middle of this festival. And I'd like to ask the question, did any great events of the Bible, of salvation, occur during this week? The week of unleavened bread. What were they? Which one might have been the greatest? We could go back to Leviticus 23, 6 through 7, and see that God commanded this festival. 15th day of the month is the festival of unleavened bread. You shall keep this feast. It's for physical Israel. It's for spiritual Israel. It's for today. The title today of my message is Great Events of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, a commanded feast by God. We know and have reviewed before coming here today in the New Testament how the Apostle Paul tells us, and this is 1 Corinthians 5:8, therefore keep this feast. As he goes through speaking of leaven, let us keep the feast of unleavened bread. So this is a New Testament event after Christ had died. Like Passover, like Pentecost, for that matter, like trumpets, like atonement, like tabernacles, like the last great day, the keeping of unleavened bread is commanded by God. As occurred on Passover and Pentecost, we expect future great events. On future feast days, trumpets, I imagine Christ will return on a day of trumpets. We don't know the day. We won't know which one. He died on Passover. He started his church on Pentecost. Trumpets, we'll see as time passes. On the Day of Atonement, binding of Satan may very well occur somewhere in the future on one of those days. These will be world-changing events, very big events. But again, what biblical big events happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread? What were the biggest events of all that happened during this feast, today's feast, the one we're in today? Let's look at the first days of Unleavened Bread and God taking Israel out of slavery in Egypt. You know, God predicted that he would do this. If we don't go to Exodus, but we go back to Genesis 15, God said long before this would happen that this is something I'm going to do. Genesis 15, verses 13 and 14. And he's speaking to Abraham. It's actually Abram at this point. Then he said to Abram, verse 13, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years." God telling Abraham, "And also the nation whom they serve I will judge." And we know God did this. "Afterward they shall come out with great possessions." And we know they spoiled the Egyptians. Israel did. So this is God speaking about what's to come. Something that will come. And in Exodus 12 we see these events. Now let's go back to Exodus 12 now and look at the time of this Exodus. You know the very name of this book, Exodus, is for a great event in the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Exodus. Exodus comes from the Greek word exodos. It means the going out. It's the story of the Israelites leaving enslavement in Egypt following the death of the Pharaoh that Joseph knew and a new Pharaoh who didn't know them and enslaved them. It's the story of their departure under the leadership of Moses. It's a huge event. It's interesting to me as I reviewed some preparing this message how people don't want to believe the Bible and that events like this really occurred. Another thing I saw recently, I guess maybe it was yesterday, TV commentator Bill O'Reilly was talking about the marriage debate that's up now, and he's saying Christians have lost this debate. And a big part of that is because they're Bible thumpers. And that's all they do. They thump the Bible. What are we supposed to do? Isn't that the Word of God? Isn't that what we... That's our foundation. That's what we base our life on. But Bill O'Reilly is a fairly conservative fellow, but seemed to have no interest in the Bible as a reason we take the stance we do. And for the Exodus, I saw a number of these. One was a man, John H. Walton, in 2003 wrote a monograph about the date of Exodus. And he said in there, "The consensus among biblical scholars today is that there never was an Exodus of the proportions described in the Bible." So a lot of people are saying, you know, the Bible, we don't really take it literally. Another person, Carol Redmount, wrote the Oxford History of the World in 1998, and in there she said about the Exodus, "This is best seen as a story about how the God," and I don't know her, but she used lowercase g here, which is not the way that we look at God, "how the God of Israel acted to save and strengthen his chosen people. This is best seen as a story and not as history." Okay, and so we're seeing more of that in the world now, but God speaks differently. God says in Exodus 12 and verse 17, "So you shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on this same day I have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt." This is something I did, just as I said I did. "Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance." This is for physical Israel, and this is for spiritual Israel today. "In the first month, on the 14th day of the month entering, at evening you shall eat unleavened bread," and this is what we've been doing, "until the 21st day of the month at even." At evening, "and why I have brought you out of Egypt." I brought you out of sin, and we've spoken about the symbolism behind these things, and today I'm talking more about what great events these were on feast days and numbers, logistics associated with this. If we look in verse 37 of this chapter, "Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth about 600,000 men on foot besides children, about 600,000 of men besides women and children. There were many non-Israelites that went with them. There were livestock. We don't need to turn there. Numbers 146 gives a more precise total of 603,550 men of fighting age in Israel. These 600,000 plus wives, children, elderly, and the mixed multitude of non-Israelites would have numbered some 2 to 3 million people. And you've heard these quotes before. And then we find those again who will argue, this is an impossible number. This couldn't happen. Marching 10 abreast, one individual quoted, and without accounting for livestock, they would have formed a line 150 miles long. We might have them 1,000 abreast, a big group going out through this land, which was fairly flat and open there, likely makes more sense. And that would produce still a line 1.5 million miles long. We know that they walked on highways at times. The Edomites, for instance, as Israel went through there, and Israel had to petition them to allow them through, one of the things Israel said is, we will stay on the highway. And it kind of suggests that they didn't always do this. So this number could certainly move more quickly than being a line 150 miles long, as sometimes we see. With 3 million people, it made me think about big football game and the blimp looking down on University of Georgia's stadium, which is close to 100,000 people. I think it's about 95,000, or Rose Bowl's about 106,000. But if you had, if you picture that many people, then this was about 30 of those that they had to move. So it was a good number of people, large number of people they moved. And so God led them out of Egypt through 10 miracles. He did this. These verses describe a great event in the plan of salvation. I have brought you out of the land of Egypt. I'm bringing you out of sin in the New Testament, picturing later spiritual rescue of God's people now from Satan, from sin. Physical Israel with this event was free. They were heading toward a wonderful promised land. Numbers 33, 1 through 3 tells us they departed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the month. So on the first day of unleavened bread after Passover, they went out with boldness in the sight of the Egyptians. What excitement. What excitement they had to have felt when this was happening. Some might say that this exodus, this going out, this escape from slavery of Egypt, which took place immediately after Passover, at the start of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, was the greatest event to ever happen during this spring festival. Others might say it was an event occurring at the end of Unleavened Bread. Let's look at Exodus 14. Just a few pages over, Exodus 14, verse 8. 14:8, and the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and Pharaoh pursued the children of Israel. And we know Satan will pursue us. He doesn't want to let us go. So this applies to us now, and he will, and we feel this. From time to time, Pharaoh pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness, as I just read from Numbers. Verse 9, so the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and they saw them coming. Out in the distance, they saw the dust from these chariots, from the horses, from the marching men. They saw Pharaoh coming after them, as we might see Satan coming after us from time to time. And so they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried to the Lord. They cried out to God. And there may be times when we're afraid too. We can't break the grip of sin and of the world. And we can't completely allow God to rule us, to submit to God. Here they found themselves up against the Red Sea with Pharaoh's army approaching. And they were trapped. There was no way out of this mess. They fell, and so they cried out. The end of the verse 10. Verse 10, they cried out to God. Verse 15 of this chapter. And God said, the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Why do you cry to me? Remember, Remember what I just did for you. Remember all that I did. Do you think that I would let these people take you back after all I did to get you out? Does that make sense? And God said, verse 15, tell the children of Israel to go forward. This is the same message for us at times like this. I kind of like the expanded Bible, these verses 13 to 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Command the Israelites to start moving. Don't just stand there. Get going. Depart. The lesson is, don't let sin overtake us. Keep moving forward. Keep the Sabbath. Assemble together. Support and care for each other. Do what we're doing today, because Satan will pursue us, but we don't have to let him catch us. And they were up against the Red Sea here, and the Red Sea is a long body of water. It's about 1,400 miles long. At its widest point, it's about 220 miles wide. It's over a mile deep. It's 7,254 deep. In its central median trench, the average depth is 1,608 feet. Other places are not deep, as deep, at about 800 feet. This is probably the way it was up in the northern part of this Red Sea where the Israelites crossed, about 800 feet. You might picture being between two walls of water at a depth like this. I think about trees. Usually the height of trees are overestimated compared to what they really are. A 60 to 80 foot tree is quite a tall tree. A 100 foot tree in this area, they're certainly out there, but they're a bit on the uncommon side. If you picture the tallest tree you can find at 100 feet or so and put eight of those on top of each other, and that's about how deep 800 feet of water would be, and then imagine walking through with walls of that size on both sides. And then, again, in this region, just like the Exodus, I'd find the studies and the commentaries about how this could have happened. The water could have been split like this, but we really didn't need God to do it. One individual indicated an earthquake could have created a tsunami. And you've probably heard about tsunamis at the beach, tidal waves. And before they hit, the water pulls back and the tide goes out. And it's calm, and it looks calm, and people are looking like, what happened? The tide just went way out, and some might go out looking for shells that have been exposed, and that's not a good thing to do, because it's a sign that very shortly this big wave, which has pulled water back, as it's coming forward, is going to hit, so that's the time to run the other way. So one report said, you know, an earthquake could have done this. We don't need God to have created something like this if indeed it happened. Another person did a computer simulation with a 63-mile-an-hour wind for 12 hours and said, you know, that would do it. That could do it if we had a wind that fast for 12 straight hours. A problem with these, like the theory of evolution, is there a way to get God out of the picture? The wind simulation also pushed the water one way, but there wasn't a wall on the other side, so it wouldn't agree with God's description in the Bible. I personally prefer to accept the clear reality of the Bible and God's Word and believe what it says. And in Exodus 14, verse 16, God says to Moses, lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel will go through in the midst of the sea on dry ground. God's description of what he would do. In verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their left and on their right hand. Right hand, their left side. So what an amazing event on this day in unleavened bread. And there are some that think this is probably the sixth day, and there are some that think this is probably the seventh day. It's clearly associated with unleavened bread as we count through as the Israelites move forward here. If we look in Psalm 106, King David described this event, and might be worth reading now how David wrote about passing through the Red Sea, Psalm 106, verses 7 through 12. Psalm 106, 7. Our fathers in Egypt did not understand your wonders. They didn't fully understand. They did not remember the multitude of your mercies, but they rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. When they got there, they forgot all the miracles you did. They didn't remember these things. They panicked. They cried out. They didn't realize that God would never let them be caught and brought back to Israel. Nevertheless, he saved them for his name's sake, that he might make them know his mighty power, make his mighty power known. He rebuked the Red Sea also, and it dried up. He led them through the depths as through the wilderness. He saved them from the hand of him who hated them. As this will apply to us as well, saving us from Satan, saving them from Pharaoh, the hand of him who hated them, and redeemed them, as he is redeeming us now from Satan and sin, from the hand of the enemy, Pharaoh, Satan. The waters covered their enemy. There was not one left. And they believed his words and they sang his praise. So I should have said, hold your place in Exodus. But I didn't. Sorry. Exodus 14, where we were. And we can go back and see this happen, what King David wrote about. What he just wrote about in Psalm Exodus 14, where we were, in verse 26. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, so the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, however deep that might have been where they crossed there, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right and on their left. This crossing of the Red Sea by Israel meant that they were at long last, finally free from Egyptian domination. They saw them destroyed. There was no doubt. Freedom was a reality. It's kind of like when Satan is bound. He's gone. When this happens, when this Day of Atonement event happens, I think the world will feel different. I don't know what we'll do. You take a deep breath and the air will feel good. And there'll be less pressure in your head as the spirit of this being is no longer influencing everyone. And we'll say, he's gone. He's actually gone. And we saw it happen. Just as they saw this water come back over the Egyptians. And we're aware of the baptism analogies here with the Israelites and sin dying in baptismal water. So a lot of symbolism here. And this crossing of the Red Sea was a big event that occurred during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Let's look at another event that happened a bit later on a Day of Unleavened Bread after Israel entered the Promised Land. Pictures removal of sin again. Go to Joshua. Joshua before Judges chapter 5. Another event associated with Days of Unleavened Bread. Joshua chapter 5. And in this chapter, verse 10 and 11, Joshua 5:10. Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover. So we know what the time is here. The time on the 14th day of the month at twilight, just like we do, on the plains of Jericho. And verse 11, they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread, parched grain on the very same day. So we see the timing here in verse 13. At this time, it came to pass when Joshua was standing by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood, capital M for that man, stood opposite him with sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you with us or against us? Are you with us or are you for our adversaries? So this man said, no, but as the commander of the army of the Lord, I have come. And Joshua fell on his face. He realized who he was talking to. Fell on his face to the earth and worshipped. We know this isn't an angel because angels will not allow humans to worship them. They say, I'm not a god. Don't do that. And this individual said, Or he said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandals off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And the only thing that can make this piece of ground holy is that there is God there. And so we understand that this is actually Christ before he had become Christ in the Old Testament. The UCG Bible commentary, if you read that sometime back when it came out, says about these, it is apparently on the first day of unleavened bread that Joshua receives instructions from the pre-incarnate Christ, the commander of the Lord's army we just saw here in verse 15, about how Jericho is to be taken. Their first march around the city seems to have occurred later that day. And again, this is not abundantly clear, and this is what we think. And there are some who feel that the last march around the city was on the sixth day, and there are some who feel it's on the seventh. But generally agree that these are events of the days of unleavened bread. And the commentary continues, the city being only a mile away in their march around it, measuring about another mile, this would not have taken long. The subsequent marches began early in the morning, we'd see in verse 12. And on the seventh day, perhaps the last day of unleavened bread, I'm reading from the commentary now, and I wouldn't want to commit either way. Sixth day, seventh day, and unleavened bread. Our commentary says seventh day, and I think it's reasonable to presume that. They rose at dawn and marched around the city seven times before giving a great shout with the trumpet blast. At the sound of the trumpets and shouting, the walls of the city fell flat, and the Israelites could scramble over and enter the city from all directions. We can read about what the commentary was just addressing in chapter 6, verse 1. Now Jericho was securely shut up. They shut the gates. They all pulled in. They saw Israel out there. They closed the city up because of the children of Israel. None went out. None came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand. It might not look like that at this point. His king and the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go around the city once. This you shall do for 6 days. And the seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall come to pass, when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up every man before him. Verses 14 and 16, 14 to 16. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp here during unleavened bread. So they did for 6 days, but it came to pass on the seventh day they rose early, about dawn, and they marched around the city seven times in the same manner. On that day only they marched around the city seven times. And on the seventh time it happened, when the priests blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, shout, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And verse 20, so the people shouted. When the priests blew the trumpets, and it happened, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, when they heard all this, when they shouted with a great shout, the wall fell down flat. And the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. So we know where this city is now, Jericho. And the commentaries, again, will suggest that it was an earthquake that brought these walls down. And they've received considerable analysis, archaeological analysis, looking at the evidence and current, reference I found said, the analysis of the archaeological evidence reveals the destruction of Jericho took place around 1400 BC, the end of the Late Bronze Period, exactly when the Bible says the conquest occurred. This is an article called The Walls of Jericho in Creation Magazine, 1999. Findings from the destruction layer are remarkable, the article continues. For instance, there was an upper and a lower mud brick city wall, the lower one resting on a retaining wall that held the earthen embankment beneath the city in place, along with many buildings. The city wall did collapse and fell beneath itself to the base of the retaining wall, the debris creating a virtual ramp up into the city from all directions, all except one, that is, this article indicates. A short stretch of the lower city wall on the north side did not fall. And there were houses built against and into that wall. And look at verse 17 now, Joshua 6. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction. It and all who are in it, only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. So only one part of the wall didn't fall. There's also clear evidence of the city being burned, but only after the earthquake, if you will, reading the words of the article, did its damage. And if we look in verse 22 but of this chapter, but Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, "Go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her, as we said we would do, as God said to do." And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. And they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. But they burned the city, verse 24, and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and the gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. So this is what God had instructed. More remarkable still, the article continues, both Garstang, and this was a 1930s excavator, and a later colleague, Kenyon, found many storage jars full of grain that had been caught in the collapsed walls. Such a large quantity of grain left untouched gives silent testimony to the truth of yet another aspect of the biblical account. Why leave all this grain here? They were told not to touch anything but the silver and gold. And a heavily fortified city with an abundant supply of food and water, as Jericho had, there was a freshwater spring in the middle of the wall. So water was no problem for them. And they had all this food stored up under the walls. They could stay there a long time. So the article continues, a siege on them would normally take months, even years, to subdue Jericho. Yet the Bible says Jericho fell only after 7 days. The jars found in the ruins of Jericho were full, showing that the siege was short, since the people inside the walls consumed very little of that grain they had stored. As with, there was a verse I wanted to read in. Yeah, okay, here it is. As with Egypt and Sodom, Jericho was a city full of sin that God was destroying. And here it is. That's verse 18. So if we look at verse 18 of Joshua 6, and this is often why God had the Israelites destroy cities. "And you by all means abstain from the accursed things in this city, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble." So things were going on in this city that were very bad, were terrible things, shouldn't have been happening, and God said, don't touch those things. Abstain, stay away from those things. This would be a very appropriate for the end of unleavened bread. A fitting symbol of the ultimate victory over sin in the days of unleavened bread. 40 years earlier, the Israelites had crossed the Red Sea, and God brought the waters of the sea down on Pharaoh's army. I thought it was interesting as I read. One commentary said, additionally, there's reason to believe the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah may have been during the days of unleavened bread. Also, if we look in Genesis 19, we can see why this was said. Genesis 19. Verses 1 through 3. And I'm not trying to prove one way or another here, just making an observation about Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot and the angels here. Genesis 19, 1 through 3. "Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, 'Hear now, my lords, please turn to your servant's house. Come to my house. Spend the night there. Wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way.' And the angel said, they said to him, 'No, we'll spend the night in the open square.' And Lot knew that wasn't a good idea. He knew about their city, and that wouldn't be a good thing to do. Verse 3, but he insisted strongly. And they turned in to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread. And they ate." So the commentaries will indicate that this would not be an expected thing outside of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, but you would expect leavened bread rather than unleavened. So rather this occurred as is apparent with Jericho, during the days of unleavened bread or not, is not something I think we can say with certainty, but it's an interesting observation. And we have a number of events that were great victories over sin that are associated with the festival of unleavened bread. These remind and encourage us in our attempts to replace sin with God's way of life as we move through these days, as we are today in unleavened bread, all great events associated with this feast, this festival. There are other great events on days of unleavened bread that involve rededication of the people of God to their Creator. Mr. Stiglmeyer mentioned one of these last time we were here in 2 Chronicles with Hezekiah. Let's go there and look. We have Samuel's, Kings, Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. These are events are outlined in chapters 29 to 31. And I'll just go to 2 Chronicles 30. Israel had long not known God, as they tend to move through times of doing that, and as we are in one of those times now where God is not known, God is not recognized. And Hezekiah was used to reintroduce God to Israel. And in 2 Chronicles 30, verse 21, part of this we see here. So the children of Israel who were present at Jerusalem kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with great gladness. You know, I think this in a sense is a millennial thing. We will see this too as Israel, modern Israel, does not know God. They don't know His festival days. They don't know the teaching of them, the importance of them, the excitement, the joy, the meaning. And here it was being brought back. And we read about that time when people will tug on your shirt and they won't let go of you. They want to be taught so bad. And this will be our job in the next days. The children of Israel who were present kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with great gladness. And these people in the millennium are going to say to us, having forgotten unleavened bread for so long, "You mean God is real? This story is actually true? There really is hope?" And we'll have the answer, yes, that's true. And they'll keep this feast in the millennium with great gladness, just like we're reading here. Chapters 34 to 35 tell of another reform similar to this through King Josiah. Let's go there, 34-35. Chapter 35 and verse 17. 2 Chronicles 35:17. We have another one of these. And I can't help but see that this isn't a picture of what we'll have in the millennium, and it will be a very exciting and rewarding time. Excuse me. 17, and the children of Israel who were present kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days. There had been no Passover kept in Israel like this one since the days of Samuel the prophet. So it was an amazing Passover, again, as they're coming back to understanding God, who God is, what God's actually doing, that there is hope, that He's real. He's really out there as we move through this time ahead. These chapters reveal the tremendous excitement and joy God's people felt as they realized that and recommitted themselves to Him. Great events in the history of Israel that were part of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the feast we're doing today, the feast we continue to be in. But there was one other event that took place during the days of unleavened bread that is much greater in its ultimate impact than any of these remarkable events we've been reading about. What is this event? What event could be greater than these other events? Let's turn to John in the New Testament. John in chapter 19, and we'll re-enter the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Festival of Unleavened Bread, here in John 19. We'll move toward that time. John 19 and verse 31. John 19, 31, and the text says here, "Therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the bodies should not remain on the cross." So Christ and the two thieves are on the cross, and a Sabbath is coming. It's the preparation day. And in parentheses, "for that Sabbath was a high day." So Christ died on the Passover, and what high day comes after the Passover? This is the first day of unleavened bread that is approaching here. This does not at all fit the scenario of Good Friday, Easter, Sunday. This is something that's missed here. That Sabbath was a high day, and the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken so they die more quickly and they can get them off the cross before this high day dawns. And then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead and they did not break his legs. And in verse 38, after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, it was a dangerous time, for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate said, yeah, that's okay, you can do that. Verse 40, then they took the body of Jesus, they bound it in strips of linen with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one yet had been laid. So there they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day, for the tomb was nearby. Jesus died on the Passover, before unleavened bread had begun. It was the preparation day for the Sabbath, and that Sabbath was a high day. We're moving into Pentecost. In John 20, verse 1, as we're in, I don't mean Pentecost, I mean unleavened bread. I tell my students, if I say something that obviously isn't right, let me know, because I can certainly do that. Into the days of unleavened bread here. In chapter 20, verse 1, now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and we know the significance of that, another message, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. And then she ran to come to Simon Peter. Something's going on. Something's happening. And to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, this is John, the author of this book, and said to them, they have taken away the Lord from the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. Peter therefore went out, and the other disciple, and they were going to the tomb. And they're starting to remember things that Christ said. And there's excitement building in them, and they started to run. So they both ran together, verse 4, and John was faster. The other disciple outran Peter, got to the tomb first. It might be polite to run together, but he was too excited. He took off, and they ran as fast as they could. John got there first, and he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloths laying there. Yet he did not go in. He stood there and looked. And Peter came following him, and Peter went into the tomb and saw the linen cloths laying there and the handkerchief that had been around Christ's head. We might picture Christ sitting up and taking that off, and it says it was folded together, neatly folded in a place by itself. Then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in, and he saw and believed, it says of John. But generally, for as yet, verse 9, they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. And my little margin there that shows verses says they did not know. And it says understand is another word that might be used there. They didn't understand that this had to happen, that he would rise. And they quote in the middle of my Bible here, Psalm 16:10. We don't need to turn there, but that's the one that says, for you will not leave my soul in the grave, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. So they didn't fully understand this yet, to see corruption. And in verse 11, but Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping. So she had been part of this. She went to get them. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And then she saw these two angels who were there. One, two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet where the body of Christ was laying. And then they said to her, woman, why are you weeping? And she said to them, because they have taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they put him. I don't know where they took him. Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? And she, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you laid him, and I'll go get him. I'll go take him away. And Jesus said to her, Mary, Mary. And she turned to him and said, teacher. And you know how this would be when she recognized him, and she ran up and she's hugging him. what do you do when someone this close to you is suddenly back and he's alive? And Jesus said to her, verse 17, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. A lot of significance there too, as we know in other arguments, for instance, going to heaven. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. And Mary would have said, I don't want to. I'm here, you're here, I want to stay with you. And Christ said, no, we need to do this. Go get the others. Go find the others. And Mary Magdalene came, verse 18, and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord, that she had seen him, and that he had spoken these things to her. And you can feel the mounting excitement now as this is happening during unleavened bread, during the festival we're in now. And so I can return to the question I started with. What's the greatest event to have ever taken place during the festival of unleavened bread? Let's look in Matthew 28, another version of this same time, Matthew 28, in verse 1. Matthew 28, verse 1. So we're at the same time, and it's after the Sabbath. Now after the Sabbath, and this would be the weekly Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to drop to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. So they were coming there, and what we read about in verse 2, it already happened. Behold, there was a great earthquake. For an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door, and he sat on that stone. His countenance was like lightning, his clothing white as snow. This is a picture of what children of God look like. This is a picture of what spirit-born people will look like. His countenance, and the guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. They fainted away when they saw this angel. In verse 5, but the angel answered and said to the women, now when they saw, we've caught up when the women saw him, do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. And here's the great event in the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He is not here, for he is risen. And he said, the angel said, come see the place where the Lord had laid. If we were followers of Jesus, as they were, and this happened, this is the recognition, the reality, the undeniable reality. It's true. It's real. It is a reality. We remember what he said is happening at this time of his crucifixion, and we were told that he had been resurrected. What would be the topic of our conversation for the rest of the day? And through that entire night, I don't think they slept. They couldn't have. They would have been too excited. They would have been too pumped up. What would be the topic of our conversation the rest of the spring festival? What would be in our thoughts? Undoubtedly, we would be thinking about the greatest event to have ever taken place in the history of humanity. The very statement of the angel, he is risen. These days of unleavened bread where Christ rose from the death marked a turning point in the history of salvation. As Christians, we'll continue, of course, to recall the Exodus, the coming out of Egypt as a type of redemption from sin and release from the bondage of Satan. We'll still have emphasis on, and we do, eating of unleavened bread as a physical reminder that we're to become spiritually unleavened by removing sin from our lives. But at the very center of this feast and this day, at the very core of the celebration of the festival of unleavened bread, is the all-encompassing truth that Jesus was raised from the dead during this spring festival. During his last Passover service, Christ told the disciples that he would soon die. They didn't fully pick up on that. But he also told them he would live again, and because I live, you will live also. At the center of this festival, that's John 14, 19. So today we reviewed great days, great events associated with the festival of unleavened bread, the Exodus, the crossing of the Red Sea, destruction of Jericho, rededication of Israel to God, resurrection of Christ from the dead. In the fall, we can do the same for the fall festivals. And I go to the point, the same message I said at the last talk I gave about the significance of these days and what they teach us. Would we ever want to let go of God's annual high holy days? Days not remembered anymore by other churches. Days of great promise, hope, and joy. How could we not cherish these very special days, including this week, the High Feast of Unleavened Bread, and these many great events in God's plan of salvation?